Ladies and gentlemen, today is the first day of the rest of your life. And now, listen in as Tristan and Johnny bring it all to the table on the Vision Board Podcast.
Guys, welcome back. Episode 162 of the Vision Board Podcast. I'm Tristan Cannell. Alongside me, Johnny Stuffgill.
What's up, guys? What's up, Tristan? 162, who we got?
We've got Brian McKenzie, man. Someone that we're connecting the dots with. He's great friends with people like Kelly Starrett and Juliet Starrett, who we've had on the show a couple of times, and also Laird Hamilton. So he's someone doing some great things. You know, we're talking about his Instagram before the show started, and, you know, he's really the guy that's connected right now and doing some, like I said, doing some great things.
Yeah, man. Brian McKenzie is one of these guys who's been in the game for a while, started as a personal trainer, keeps doubling down with his skill set. He's a lifelong learner. Go to his Instagram. You'll see him in John Jones's locker room, the UFC star. He's popped up in Tim Ferriss's last two books. This guy has really figured out the equation of knowing what he's good at, figuring out his strengths, learning, and then finding how to streamline that into his own brand.
Yeah, definitely. He's just not a cookie cutter sort of trainer. He's done the expertise. He's put the yards in. Do you know what I mean? He's tested a lot of things on his own body, his own athletes. The breathing work that he does is fantastic, and it's gonna be great to pick his brain and just kind of, because, you know, I'm not an expert in breathing or anything like that. It's something that does really fascinate me ever since I went to Steve Maxwell's seminar. So I really want to get his different perspective on things.
Yeah, we've had the breathing pop up a couple of different times with Roe. We've had it. I remember when I did the Rogan episode with Wim Hof. He literally would take you through the breathing scenario. And Brian, like you just said, I like the biggest point about the whole preface with McKenzie is that he's not your run-of-the-mill trying to be like somebody else. Mm. This guy testing his own philosophies on himself. He's a performance and endurance athlete. He's a writer. These things have been proven to work for him. And everything he seems to have his fingers in, he's up there. Like his echelon of like his network, Kelly Surrett, his wife is an Olympian, his friends with Tim Ferriss, et cetera, et cetera. Like you said, Laird, Gabby. And I think that that's the secret in figuring out once you are able to understand what you're good at, and then from there, doing things like that streamline, that are congruent with what you're good at. And in this case, it's definitely around the fitness, health, wellness sort of thing.
Yeah, it's going to be cool to get on. Before we get him on, just a big shout out to everyone tuning in, leaving us 5-star reviews on iTunes. If you haven't yet, please log on to iTunes, subscribe and leave us a 5-star review. Helps us grow the show, helps us appear more in iTunes, and we can just reach more people and help spread the message of people like Brian, Laird, Kelly, and get all their messages out there. And it just helps people get solid, valuable information.
You could follow the Vision Board Podcast on Twitter. You could follow the Vision Board Podcast on our Facebook page. Johnny Stoffco, Tristan Cannell. We love the support, the Vision Board.
Absolutely, you guys. But without further ado, I introduce Brian McKenzie. It makes me warm now. Our special guest is Brian McKenzie. Brian is a human performance and movement specialist. He's the founder of CrossFit Endurance and has spent countless hours training and understanding in and around water, desert, and has participated in Ironman, ultra marathons, and has even co-authored two outstanding books, The Power Speed Endurance and the New York Times bestseller, The Unbreakable Runner. I welcome Brian McKenzie. Brian, welcome to the podcast, man.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Brian, Tristan's intro covered a lot. We have a lot to cover. I want to start actually with some your Instagram handle. I am unscared. So let's, yeah, because fear, you know, we talk a lot of mindset on this show. Fear is a big player in a lot of people's dreams and goals, and a lot of people fail to even get started. So give us some insight on, you know, not allowing fear as a player in your goals and where that handle came from.
Well, the actual word was made up by the guy who you just brought up, which was Kelly Starrett. And we were at a dinner about 9 years ago, actually 10 years ago now. So we were at a dinner 10 years ago, and Dave Castro, who runs CrossFit Games, and he's the director for training and stuff, said a rather ridiculous remark at dinner. And it was about endurance sports and cycling people wearing arm warmers. And he thought that anybody who wore arm warmers was gay. And, and Kelly just kind of perked up and was like, and tilted his head. And Kelly used to have a gym that was outside in San Francisco. And he said, "Hey, Dave, I have a gym that's outside in San Francisco. And in the mornings, it's freezing balls. And so I wear arm warmers because it warms up and I take the arm warmers off, but I'm not gay." And he said, "So what I'm going to do is I'm going to get a pair of pink arm warmers and I'm going to get the word unscared written on it because I am unscared of you." And we just laughed. And then we kind of just came with that word. And, you know, being, I mean, the idea is that you can't live without fear. Fear exists in everything. And it's a part of nature. I had some hippie woman a couple months ago at one of the stores I go to. She asked what was on my knuckles, and it says unscared.
Wow. Hey,
she's like, "Oh, you know," or my fingers. And she's like, "Oh, that's so interesting." And she's like, "But, you know, like you don't have to have fear," because I said it's the art of dealing with fear. And she goes, "Well, you don't need fear." And I said, "Well, you die without fear." She says, no, that's just wisdom. And I'm like, "Well, what if you if you had no fear, you'd cross the street without looking." She goes, "No, that's wisdom." And we kind of went round and round on that. And although she was correct about the wisdom part and understanding that there is things that keep us alive in essence, due to fear. And it's naturally a part of everything we do. And it's like, it's why you don't step off, you know, if you've ever skateboarded, you know, dropping into a ramp for the first time. There's a lot of fear surrounding something like that. Mm. All right. But you do it anyway, if you want to do it right, you're going to step up at some point. And so that you override that fear. And so unscared is more or less the idea of it's the art of dealing with fear. I'm open to dealing with this. It was, you know, the basis of why I ran ultra marathons. Like, I'm not a small guy. I was arguably one of the biggest dudes who was running ultra marathons when I was running ultra marathon, you know, and that this is like 10 years ago. Mm. So, you know, I mean, I'm 190 pounds. You know, I'm 6'1", 6'2", and you know, I wanted to figure some things out, and I figured out a different way to train. And, you know, that was the first book, Power, Speed, Endurance. And, you know, but that was being kind of unscared. I don't need to be some small whippet to do this. And I did fairly well. That said, it transcends into everything we do, our behavior, our, you know, our relationships, everything. So I think that's what the I am unscared is about. Mm. Is more or less, hey, like, you've got to just grab the things that, you know, you're really kind of afraid of doing, or if you can recognize what's going on and just get after it and do it anyway.
Yeah, is that part of your personality, the fact that you kind of want to prove people that you can do something that they say you can't do?
No, it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was. I mean, that's how I grew up. You know, people told me I couldn't, you know, like, here, I went to school only to get the grades that would allow me to play sports. Yeah. And I basically went to enough school just to do that.
Yeah, man.
Meaning I didn't go to a lot of school.
Yeah, happens, man.
Yeah, I was in college playing baseball, and I remember as the, you know, my second year was coming to an end, I went to my guidance counselor, which I had no relationship with her. And I said, what classes do I need to finish? Because I'm halfway done. I really don't have a major. What do I need to take so I could finish? Same sort of thing. Brian, man, once again, I'm going to reference that Instagram of yours. What were you doing? Talk to us about John Jones and that photo. And TK and I are big MMA, big MMA fans. I've been watching MMA UFC, man, since mid to late 90s. We interview these guys, you know, a lot of those guys from Jackson's have been on our show. That photo, though, specifically not just you and John, but the space you were sharing and the temperament of him giving you that. And man, it's a remarkable, interesting, intriguing photo. Could you talk a little bit about it?
Certainly. John is a very unique human being. and he's arguably one of the most talented individuals that's ever walked the planet in terms of fighting. He's very unorthodox in his approach and how he does things. There aren't a lot of people that fight like him. And in that, he's walked a very, you know, a very different path as well. But I think he's a deeply spiritual person, a person who wants to do right, a person who wants to explore the world. And he doesn't want to do it with a lot of ego. And that was why I was actually introduced to him. I really only put myself in places at this point in my career with people who are actually open like that. I don't have time for the ego, and for people who are really just like, you know, oh, I breathe every day, I don't need to do this shit, you know, like, and it's like, well, no, you don't actually. So, you know, we don't have anything to talk about. Like, we just don't, you know, and it has nothing to do with breathing, you know, but John came to me for something like that. He was introduced to me for that very reason, because they thought it would help him in the week leading up to the fight. And he finally reached out and was just like, hey, you think you can help me out? And I said, well, let's just see. And so I put him through a simple down regulation protocol on a FaceTime video, and he literally fell asleep. Wow. So, you know, and he was like, what the fuck just happened? And I'm like, well, look, you know, breathing is the remote control of the brain. And if you can really take the time to just downshift and stop looking at things the way that everybody's really grabbing on to everything, like, I need it now, you can really start to change things, and you can really open up your mind to a lot of potential. That dovetailed into an entire week of me working with him and just being at his side. And he asked if he could fly me down for the fight so that I could prep him heading out to the fight. And so that was the idea, was that I came down and I got that opportunity, and I told him not a problem. Of course, you know, I make sure it's okay with my wife, and, you know, hey, is it all right if I jolt down to go to this fight? Yeah. Who is he? He's just a fighter, you know, this guy. And she's like, yeah, no problem. Yeah, totally. Like she really, I mean, she kind of knows, but doesn't really know. She knows who, the funny thing was, is that she knows who Holly Holm is, you know, because she was the one that knocked out Ronda Rousey. And so, you know, and she was big in, Aaron's big into, you know, women doing great things. And, you know, so she definitely knows who that was. And I mean, Holly came into the training room prior to us exiting, and I got to meet her, and I told Aaron I got to meet her, and she was like, that's so bitchin'. And, you know, and she's a big girl, and we like big girls. And, you know, so at any rate, I was very fortunate to get that opportunity. And John is very open. And, you know, we talked about a story that, you know, is about physiology and nature and about the lion and the antelope. And I put this out on my Instagram before, but it's a very important story in that there's no physiological differences that we know between either animal when the antelope's being hunted by the lion, or whatever animal the antelope's being hunted by. It could be hunted by a cheetah, right? Mm-hmm. Or hyenas, but there's no physiological differences. There's just one difference though. And that is, the lion wants to be there. And that's where we set the state of what John, you know, really wanted to do. And so we talked about that, and he got a like, oh shit, like, I get this. And I'm like, yeah, so now let's set the physiology with the breathing, wire this in, and, you know, we go. And he was stoked. So
have you done work with fighters of that caliber before?
Yeah. So I work with Ruka. Okay. And Ruka runs a human performance facility out of their, compound that's private. And so Jason Perillo works out of there. So does a guy by the name of Bryce Krause, who's a, Muay Thai fighter.
Yep.
And so I see a lot of the top fighters in the world there. Not all of them I come in contact with, but yeah, I mean, I've been in the MMA kind of scene behind the scenes. With what I do, whether it's breath work related, or whether it's strength and conditioning related, or movement related. So,
yeah, with so little time, obviously you said you first met John Jones a week before your actual fight. What's the first kind of fundamental thing that you do to help him with the breathing?
It was simple. Just down-regulate him. Yeah. Like, hey, how can I help? And he's just like, you know, our mutual friend speaks very highly of you. If he speaks highly of you, I believe you are probably the best. So that's kind of the way in with these with a lot of these athletes is they don't want to necessarily like. But here's the other thing: is if you're an athlete and you want to, or it doesn't even matter if you're an athlete or not. If you're a professional and you want to be the best version of you, you've got to do you.
Yeah.
And too many of us are focused on doing what the other guy's doing. And so it's like, hey, I want to know what John Jones' training program is. No, you don't. No, you don't.
Yeah.
You need to know what your training program is. You need to know what works for you. And sure, I'm going to get hit up, and I have been hit up for many more people who want to do some breath work. But here's the thing. Not everybody's the same.
Yeah.
And that's the uniqueness about what it is we've learned and we're learning and doing is we're showing people that there's actually a fingerprint for you in what changes your state, whether it's down regulation, up regulation, whether it's developing better CO2 tolerance to lower a respiration rate, which is a healthier thing. You know, there's a lot of rabbit holes that open up on this thing.
Go ahead. How do you get them away from actually thinking that they need John Jones, though?
That's what a world champion is.
Yeah.
You know, that's the difference between world champions and everybody who's finishing second and third the rest of the time or below. You know, it's they're trying to do what everybody else is doing usually or the rest of the pack. And that's just something I've picked up on.
Yeah.
You know, like my wife did everything different than everybody.
Yeah. Two-time Olympic gold medalist too.
Yeah, we were talking.
And 5'9", 150 to 160 pounds. She's not 6'2", 190 to 200 pounds. My size, you know, that's what her teammates were.
Yeah, I was talking to a very successful business coach. He works with millionaires. And from a business perspective, performance perspective, that advice for the listener is a key point about we always try to want to identify or attach ourselves to who's killing it, who's on top, no matter what industry we're in. And we think that, okay, let me do what they're doing. You'll only get to a certain level if you're going to mimic them. And it's like you're saying, you have to be the contrarian. You have to figure out what works for you and then do something to have a point of difference. Now, when you use words like down regulation to the layman, like myself and our, you know, people listening at home, a lot of coaches and clients, what is that? What is down regulation simplified?
So we've got two states largely in our autonomic nervous system. You've got your parasympathetic nervous system and you've got your sympathetic nervous system. All right. And so these largely relate to these two things. And in our day and age, we are very sympathetic dominant with what we do. This has incredible depth to it. From a mechanical standpoint, which is I got into breath work, okay? Because we started figuring out that everything we were talking about with movement and being in a better position and understanding position also related to engaging the diaphragm and not being out of position and being able to get air in, right? Well, that also led to the physiology and understanding the responses that are happening. And largely, most people are mouth breathers. So your mouth, it real quickly, is designed for your digestion and communication. We're using it now. We're all going to be elated or elevated after this is done. I'm getting ramped up now. You're probably getting ramped up. You're getting excited. This is sympathetic tone, okay? Nose is designed, it is a part of your respiratory system. You have two smaller holes, you have hairs, you have mucus, you have sinuses, and you have gases that can be emitted through the sinuses. One largely is nitric oxide, which is a massive component to physiological adaptation and things. And we largely escape that because we sit more, we're out of position, we're here more. Regardless of what we're doing, I'm as guilty as anybody on this, right? But it's like I have to think about it because I'm like, oh, wow, what happens as a result of that? I fold to a shitty position. I can't get air in through my nose because I'm in a shitty position. So then I just go because I can get more air in. So the mouth, yes, you can use it for breathing. It's for emergency cases, right? Take high level training or hard training. Yes, it's there. But throughout the day, if we're using the nose, we're keeping a more parasympathetic tone. Parasympathetic is rest, digest, reproduce. Sympathetic is fight, flight, freeze.
Hmm. Brian, just sticking on breathing, have you ever heard of a gentleman by the name of Steve Maxwell?
Yes, I know. I know who Steve Maxwell is.
Yeah, I went to one of his breathing seminars, and he was just teaching us different breathing maneuvers. So, for example, they put us in a lot of BJJ holds that would generally make you hurt. And he just taught us these breathing exercises that literally kind of tricked the brain into forgetting that the pain was there. So I guess for someone, my question is for someone that's done ultras and Ironman, and I know the, you know, all that sort of pain that you go through, there is ways of using breathing to trick the mind that it's not in pain anymore, right?
It's not even necessarily tricking the mind. There's actually a physiological response. Raise the alkalinity of the body and you shut down the pain receptor sites of the cells.
Wow.
It's just math.
Yeah, it's mind-blowing, but the fact that you could
But that comes with a cost, all right? So you can, yes, slow your breathing down. That's going to add more parasympathetic, so that's going to down-regulate you more. It's going to calm you down. It's actually a good thing. So this is something we talk to BJJ guys all the time.
Hmm.
In fact, even the guy who's my instructor, like
– Yeah, you roll, used, right?
Huh?
You roll.
Yes.
Yeah.
Not enough, but yes. I live in the middle of nowhere, so it's like for me to commit to go to a class, it's like a 3-hour endeavor. And I just don't have that kind of time. So when I travel, I just go to people and I go to my guy and whatever. So, that said, he's been using a lot of its techniques, and I got him to one of our seminars, and it just blew his mind. And he was like, dude, there's so much we could be applying to what we're doing with guys. And it's, we teach, I mean, how many guys when their white belts come in and they're just like, they gas out right away.
Yeah.
They're gassed because they're like this. If they just taught themselves to breathe through their noses, they'd slow the fuck down and they're actually, they have a clearer response because the physiology, what happens when we go into sympathetic tone is the vasculature to the brain. So the arteries and stuff constrict. So you've got less blood flow, which means you've got less oxygen, which means you're in a heightened alert state, which you're only reactive. You're not calmer and more clear. So this is what you'll see with people who then become, let's take it on the flip side, a black belt, who's calm, non-reactive. He could subdue you any moment, or he's thinking about 18 moves ahead, you know, and it's just like, I'm going to work my way slowly there and I don't need to overreact because I know what I'm doing. Yes, that takes time, but what also is going on? There's a physiological response. He's probably not breathing through his mouth too much, right? He's calmer. He's breathing through his nose. And this is just part, you know, these are little parts to like what we do. Mm. But, you know, to the upregulation, downregulation is it's like, hey, to downregulate, it's like, look, if I've had a stressful day, the best thing you can do is actually take some breathing protocols, implement them for like 3 minutes. I'm telling you, in less than 3 minutes, you can literally downshift your entire physiology to go into this parasympathetic tone to set the body up to start to recover. Because the sooner you're recovering, the better you get. And then it's, hey, if I'm going to go train or I'm waking up in the morning, I'm going to upregulate. So I'm going to turn on more of that sympathetic tone.
Brian, what's your opinion on this? Did you get, well, first question is, did you get to talk with John after the fight? And this,
yes.
Awesome. And the second question is this, you know, Tristan was with me when we were watching the fight. And when John catches DC with that head kick, there was a slight second, like the world stopped. He paused. And then it reminds me of what you said, the lion and the gazelle. He saw that DC was hurt. He paused, gathered himself, and then he just pounced on him and finished the fight. Now, if you watched the fight earlier, the Tyron Woodley fight versus Maya, Tyron clipped Maya in the very first part of that fight and didn't attack.
Mm.
So my question is, do you feel that, you know, coming from a mindset coaching perspective, that killer instinct can be taught? Do you think you have to be born with it? And what John did in contrary to what Tyron didn't do, did you guys get to talk about it? And what's your insights on it?
We didn't get to talk about the Tyron fight and Maya fight, but I mean, that was so frustrating to me because I watched this thing and I'm like, dude, you're just trying to hold on to that belt.
I know,
like,
man.
Don't let go of that idea and you will literally, you're going to stop. You're going to end this fight right now. Yeah, and, but he just didn't have it in him. Do I think that can be taught? Yes, absolutely. Oh. 100%. I think anything can be taught. I legitimately do. I could say yes. I think John Jones is talented, but I don't buy into talent. I buy into he saw things at a very young age, was taught things at a very young age, decided to learn things at a very young age in a certain way that inevitably sets him up to be who he is and how he deals and copes and handles things, right? I think I have been given those very same opportunities in different ways. And I took advantage of certain things. Are there ways that I could have improved early on? Absolutely. The issue becomes as I age, it becomes more and more difficult for me to change. And this is the big paradigm here. The shift is, this is where that unscared motto comes in. It really fits in here because the moment we stop learning, the moment we get caught up in our own dogma, in our own way of living, and there's only one way to do it, and I am this or the identity factor, is over. Life starts to end. And I have watched this time and time and time again. Not only did it start with my grandparents and my parents, but it's like I watch athletes. Like the athlete who doesn't want to do something new or different.
Like I'm the striker or I'm the grappler sort of thing, right?
You got it. Yeah. You got it. You got. Hey, how many fighters have we all watched who failed to evolve?
Matt Brown, man. No offense. That's our boy. You know, we love the immortal. But yeah, it's like, dude, get your black belt in BJJ. Learn how to grapple. Yeah. Learn how to defend the double. Yeah. But yeah, man.
Yep.
Brian, what about with training? Is at the moment, especially with, you know, these big combat sports, you see them training every day, three times a day. In your experience, is that too much?
I don't necessarily I wouldn't say three times a day is too much. I would say the amount of time that's being spent in each of those sessions may be too much. You know, and here's a big thing. Like we all you guys, I mean, does everybody understand what cortisol does?
Yeah. It's released. Okay. Yeah.
45 minutes of hard training, cortisol starts to get released.
Yep. That's a fact.
What's happening? So why am I spending 3 hours or 2 hours in a session? I just listened to a podcast with Joe Rogan and Dorian Yates.
And Dorian, we were gonna talk about that.
Here's a guy who's arguably the greatest bodybuilder in history and never spent more than 50 minutes in the gym.
Yeah, four times a week though. I was gonna ask you that. I was like, and then Tristan and I were off air, and he was like, "Dude, I believe it because the intensity." But man, if that's the case, everybody's overtrained. All my clients, your clients, you know.
I do it. Yeah. You do it. We do. Everybody does it. Like I get caught up in it too.
Yeah.
But that's the thing is we all get caught up in this and we're not paying attention. Hey, look, it ain't easy to go hard. It ain't easy that's to true. Fit in what some guys are doing in 2 hours into 45 minutes. Okay. Right. And it can be dangerous, especially if I'm not skilled enough.
Okay. So is it more of a case then of being more efficient in the gym and timely, or is it really just the time aspect? Because feedback I would get in, we'd give each other is like, dude, I just turned 35. You can't push it how you did at 25. But if I'm pushing it for an hour and a half and no, like, I have the headphones in, not bullshitting with the boys, just getting in. Now, is that when the cortisol begins to release, that's going to happen regardless at that 45-minute mark if I'm just doing three sets sort of thing?
It's a variable thing. Yeah. But, you know, looking into it and you look at the research and you start to understand these things, this is why research is important. It's not, hey, it's 45 minutes. It's roughly it's 45 minutes. Now, how do I figure that out for me? Where is the diminishing return? Hence, developing a program which was CrossFit Endurance, but is now Power Speed Endurance. Look, the longest run I did leading into a 100-mile run was an hour and 28 minutes.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. Yeah.
It was an hour and 28 minutes pegged, like fucking hurting so hard and just going as hard as I could at the time. And for a guy that weighed what I did and was doing what I was doing, that was a half marathon. Okay. That said, most of my training took place under 45 minutes, ironically, because I saw the deterioration start to occur at that. Is it odd that even if you look at marathoners or even aerobically trained athletes, that VO2 levels increase up till 5K? Mm. Like they're doing great things up to 5K, and between 5K and 10K, they relatively just raise a little. But out past 10 kilometers, there is no real change. So what does 10K take most people? 35 to 45 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So tell the audience how long those 100 miles take you, though, in reference to what you were training.
Roughly 26 to 27 hours.
Hours. Wow. And you're only.
Yeah. But there's nothing healthy about that endeavor. Okay. And we're not by design supposed to be running 100 miles. Mm. We can't.
Yeah.
And we can do it. But there's very few people that do this for long periods of time.
Brian, if you don't mind me asking, Tristan and I were talking to another endurance athlete and writer, Rich Roll. And he was opening our eyes about, the common denominator of the mindset a lot of these gentlemen and women who do these events. And we were talking about addiction, depression, that sort of thing. When you were a younger dude, were these things that you struggled with? Is there a connection with why you want to push your body to that level? Maybe something you went through when you were younger, certain adversities like that?
Sure. Oh, certainly. Yeah. I had a very, very, so I know Rich. I've done Rich's podcast. We've communicated, and he's done some phenomenal stuff, but I will tell you right now, I found that a lot of that long distance training was no different than me just literally chugging booze, snorting lines. And yes, it might be healthier and it might make me feel better. But the fact of the matter is that there's no other life than that. And if that's your life, that's great. How are you affecting other people? Somebody like Rich Roll figured something out. He's got a podcast. He's learning how to filter that out. That said, there's a lot of research out there on looking at lifelong endurance athletes, people who are doing lots of mileage, and the amount of free radicals that are being exposed to those people are massive.
Yeah, in terms of life expectancy, right? They did that study with the Olympic athletes and the long-distance marathon runners. Over the longest period of time are the ones who live the shortest, right?
You got it.
And you say free radicals. Could you talk a little bit about, to the person listening, on what's happening in the body during these long systemic events?
Oxidative stress, big time. So it's just – so when I start working in an aerobic way, right, or primarily aerobic, it all works together. I am – using oxidation to oxidize glucose and fat. And so I'm high level mitochondria is spinning up and using it's oxidizing these things. So oxidation creates free radicals. So think of it as kind of like just like what's a byproduct of actually work? Breath rate. My respiration rate goes up. Constantly raising that respiration rate is not necessarily like all day long is not necessarily a good thing. Hence why, like you do an ultra marathon or you do some long training events and your lungs hurt the next day.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of factors in it, but they find out if these endurance athletes have cardiovascular disease, a lot of this stuff later on in life. And, I get it. I still run. I still ride. I just keep it in my zone, man. And from time to time I go out a little bit longer and I spend some time out there, but that's just what I've found to be kind of how things work. And I don't ever have a problem going longer and slower.
Yeah.
It's always the shorter and harder.
What's up, guys? Be sure to pick up your free copy of Conversations with Champions. This is our free ebook, which is comprised of inspirational quotes from past guests that we've had on the show.
Get inspirational quotes from champions such as Evander Holyfield, Jonathan Thurston, Grant Cardone, Gary Vee, Larry Holmes, Mario Andretti, Anthony Mundine, Joe DeFranco, and many, many more.
To pick up your free copy now, just simply go to our website, www.thevisionboardpodcast.com/ebook. Put your name and email in the slot. It takes about 10 seconds, and we'll send you the book directly to your inbox. Now back to the show.
Brian, just taking in everything you're saying, it's just like literally these people training for ultra marathons. And you can even, we all love combat sports. It's like literally you train for 12 rounds, but they do a lot of sparring for 12 rounds, but it's nearly unnecessary. So do you think they kind of leave it in the gym and do their best things in the gym? They come up to the event and they're only kind of like at 70, 80% because they've just used that all in the gym.
Yeah, we've gotten into this thing in human performance with suffering. Mm. And like I was saying, my wife can outsuffer anybody. Like she just beat the tar out of me today in a workout, right? Because she can just suffer. But that's what we've largely looked at as the way to do sport. Yeah. How long can you actually suffer? For instance, to become a Navy SEAL, you've got to go through a program in a selection process called BUDS, mm-hmm. Basic Underwater Demolition School.
Yeah.
That is all about how hard they can make you suffer. And so people take and there's a reason why they do that. Because they want to find out who is a team player under sufferability. That does not mean that is your life. And that's the problem, is that we take on, and a lot of these guys I run into and I work with, I mean, I've spent some serious time inside special forces units, and it has a trickle down effect. So everybody thinks they need to train in this manner to beat themselves up.
Yeah.
The manner to train for an event, regardless of what that is, in order to do it, yet spending the quality time. Look, if I went and spent less than an hour in the gym training for an event and just put in as much quality as I could, skill development, intensity, like all of it, right, in 45 minutes, then went and ate, and then maybe took a nap, then woke up and felt $1 million, time to go train again, get it on, get the body going again, let the body recover. Yeah. If you're letting the body recover and getting back to it, there's no reason why you can't double down, triple down.
Brian, with your programs, you like to do skills first, correct? And then you get into a lot more high intensity stuff, right?
Yes. Yeah. We do a lot of skill development early on in the training. You know, and actually force the workouts we develop. We use a lot of the CrossFit ideology or methodology, but we use it to train positions for skill development. Mm. So we would do something complex skill wise, coupled with something that's metabolically highly demanding, and then forcing you to actually really get into a good position. And if I can't get in that position, then I've got to wait until I've recovered enough to get into that position and do something.
Could you explain to us and our listeners about what altitude and hypoxic training is and why it's important to either incorporate or supplement it into somebody's routine?
Yeah. So altitude training has always been, like, we've been, I shouldn't say always, it long been a part of any high-level athlete's game. We've, by and large, used the train low, live high concept. Mm-hmm. So training where there's more oxygen to get the most benefit out of training, and then sleeping and recovering at low oxygen to get the body to stimulate more red blood cells or hemoglobin in order to put more oxygen into the bloodstream. So red blood cells pick up oxygen. The more red blood cells you have, the more oxygen you pick up and becomes bioavailable, right? The interesting process with that is that you actually need to be, well, you don't need to, but you should be, the more efficient you are with oxygen metabolism, meaning how you utilize oxygen, which is actually a component of CO2 tolerance with inside the lungs, the better you are at that. That said, if I'm at a high altitude, it's not that there's less oxygen there. It's that the pressure isn't there. So it's harder for me to absorb the oxygen. So I absorb less oxygen. The interesting thing that happens to the body is that my blood oxygen levels, so I keep raising my finger, if I put on a pulse oximeter, I can look at my blood oxygen levels. And if I'm at, let's just call it 6,000 feet, and I haven't been to 6,000 feet, the pulse oximeter is probably going to read between 92 and 94%, which is hypoxic. Okay. So I'm dealing with hypoxia. So at low blood oxygen levels, normal levels are between 95 and 98, roughly. Okay. And if I go higher, the blood oxygen level goes lower. Well, you can also do this through holding your breath to a large degree.
So
go ahead.
Yeah. On that with the, you know, train high, is this something, you know, you would recommend for an athlete preparing to fight in Mexico City or a American football player playing in Denver, or do it all the time, not just because you have to play or perform at a place that's higher altitude? Because I remember when Kane went to Mexico City, Velasquez, and he fought Verdum, and he didn't acclimate to that level, and it was one of his worst performances. And then there was a Pittsburgh Steeler when I went to college there who went to Denver, and he ended up having to get his appendix removed. And it was one of these things that the media wrote that they weren't acclimated to performing at that altitude. Now, when we're talking about hypoxic training, is this something that you're talking for the athlete to do year round or just in that scenario?
I would be doing it year round.
Okay.
I do it every week, probably 3 to 4 times a week. I've got some sort of hypoxic training going on. It also, the hypoxic training helps build CO2 tolerance to a large degree, which teaches you how to deal with higher acidic levels in the body. So a lot of people like to say lactic acid, but that doesn't have anything to do with it. Lactic acid is just a byproduct of lactate, which is part of your anaerobic system, but it's largely your body's pH that is changing, or that you're becoming acidic, which is the process by which you start to burn, right? And so you can mimic that just sitting right there.
Are we talking with the masks?
Okay, I'm going to hold my breath. And then when I need to breathe, I'll take one breath and I'm going to do that for 5 minutes. Watch what happens to your blood ox. So this is where it gets fun, is you start connecting dots within research and here and there. And it's like, look, if I do proper hypoxic training, I can actually raise EPO levels in my body by 21%. That's almost blood doping, dude.
And that's what the, what? That's crazy.
Yeah. But here's the thing. The Russians figured out years ago, training their pilots for high altitude, that if they that those who did interval training with hypoxic training versus or altitude training, because they use an altitude simulator and they would have guys on it for 5 or 6 minutes, then they'd go normal for 4 or 5 minutes. So, and then they do that for about an hour, right?
Wow.
So it's no different if I go walk around, if I go train, or if I'm just sitting at my desk, if for an hour I'm just like, I hit a timer for 5 minutes, I just hold my breath and I get one breath of recovery or two or three, but I'm trying to keep my blood oxygen levels below 94%.
So this is, you could do this without like any equipment.
I've shown up to 10,000 feet climbing a mountain in the middle of winter, and I was living in Southern California, and it did not affect me in the slightest. And my buddy who went up with us was falling apart at the seams. And I used to fall apart at the seams routinely when I would train for ultras and I'd first go up to altitude, which was why I got altitude. I have an altitude machine. And I have an altitude mask thing it's called Alto Lab. And that also it forces your blood oxygen levels to drop as well, which it's interesting because they all have you watching your blood oxygen levels. And so all we had to do was I was basically working through some breath work and I was doing altitude training. And I'm like, wait a second. Wonder what happens. And then, you know, you start to read about it. And there's a great book out there by a guy by the name of Patrick McEwen called Oxygen Advantage. Mm-hmm. And he wrote extensively about this. He solidified everything I had already figured out with what he had done years ago and was doing.
You mentioned the mask, and Johnny did as well. In terms of using that in training, when's the best time to use it? How do we use it?
Like commercially versus pro athletes wise too, right? You see it at commercial gyms.
You do.
Like, well, which mask?
Not the one you're talking about. So you know the one.
The one that makes you look like Bane.
The training mask. That was actually what got me involved in breathing, was the training mask. Because I laughed at it. And I was like, this doesn't simulate altitude. Because pressure has to change. And it's not changing pressure, right? And it wasn't stopping the amount of oxygen coming. We're still getting the same amount of oxygen. So I was just like, and I made fun. I'm like, this is stupid. And, but I had never put it on and I had never tried it. And then that was, boom, there's that unscared whole thing again. I'm like, oh, I'm talking to something I don't know. And I, or I haven't experienced yet. So I put the mask on and instantaneously I changed position, accessed a diaphragm that I didn't really realize I had. And I was like, holy crap. And then I started working from different positions and found that I was actually creating better motor control, which better motor control means better positioning, all of that stuff. And I was like, holy shit. Like, why isn't anybody using it like this? So we use it in warmups, whether it's aerobic to create a resistance warmup. We figured out that if you actually used a resistance breathing device during warmups, you get the respiratory system and pulmonary system warmed up with the body. So that place where, like, you know, 20 minutes in, you feel really good. Like if you're doing a run or you're on your bike, that's actually the respiratory system catching up with the cardiovascular and muscular systems. Okay. So everything's then congruent. So we figured out using it like that helped tremendously. And then using it during recovery was the best. Mm. Now, we also found that using it during training, it's not the best idea because you're probably going to fatigue yourself a lot sooner. And most people don't want to stop due to fatigue. And that's where the sits, like with Kelly Starrett's work and my work, is like we start seeing people adapt to these really shitty positions and they move really poorly. And so that's where we want to keep in mind that if you're going to go out for a 5K run in a mask, in a resistance training mask, you need to understand you're going to fatigue yourself a lot differently. And so you're probably going to morph to pretty poor positions a lot earlier. And, you know, training is all about getting the biggest bang for your buck. And so it's really like, hey, use it for, like, we found that using it for a warm up, using it for like core development, motor control stuff. You know, like think of a plank, like getting into a plank, go try it, go into a plank and do it without a resistance breathing device, then go into a plank and put the resistance breathing device on. You will see a big difference in how you set up. And that's part of the whole learning curve, man, is just really like, wow, things were like, there's things out there we weren't looking at. Right.
Brian, you just mentioned warming up before. Is there any particular foundation things that you do in across all your athletes?
Can you repeat that?
With your warm-ups, is there something in your foundations that you do across the board with all the athletes, or is it kind of specific depending on what sports they kind of do?
Typically, I don't do a lot of coaching, although we run an online program with Power Speed Endurance. What I like to see is at minimum a 10-minute aerobic warm-up with people. And you know, you actually have a resistance breathing device on your face, which is your nose.
Yeah.
You know, and so forcing people to actually nasal breathe while they warm up is a big change for people. So aerobic warm-ups are key, and then actually getting into some of the more dynamic positions and forcing good positions out of those and being dynamic with it in the warm-up is big. So it just depends on the movements that we're using and what we're doing with how we're going through stuff. But now the things that have changed that have become commonplace are like breath work prior to actually starting, and then breath work post-workout to kind of help that downshift and get the tissue ready to, you know, relax quicker.
Brian, something I've been really into lately is like what's happening with, you know, the advent and the evolution of social media, and then people like the collective's work ethic in terms of like instant gratification, impulsive, like not really being committed to their strengths in terms of like you, for instance, everything that you do is streamlined into your strengths, whether you're coaching, whether you're performing, whether you're writing, your circle of influence. You popped up in Tim Ferriss's For Our Work Week. You were in his Souls of the Titans. I want you now to give us and our listeners advice to the coaches who have maybe been in the game 1 to 2 years, maybe thinking about quitting. When did things start lighting up for you? When did those bells start hitting, you know, in essence of your career, when you knew you were like, all right, I've been putting the work in, things are about to pop off, let me just stay committed to the cause?
You'll understand this. I started at 24 Hour Fitness.
Wow. That's crazy, yeah. Man. In LA? Yeah.
In Orange County, and I was there 3 weeks before I quit. And I almost stopped training people right there because I thought that was what was training, was selling personal training to people. And I was selling personal training at $75 an hour, and I was making, I think, 30,
yeah,
maybe less, 25, which was just mind-boggling to me. I'm like, what the fuck? Like, it just drove me nuts. I was in school and I got an opportunity to utilize somebody else's empty gym during the day. It was a spin gym and it was just an opportunity. And I took that opportunity and I had one client for like the next 2 months. So I was basically making like $400 the next 2 months. And I gutted it out, man. But I gutted it out because I was learning. I was learning so much with what I was doing. And I was like, at the time I was doing really well in school. Like I was at a community college, junior college at the time.
Which one?
And Orange Coast College.
Orange Coast College. Okay.
Right, yeah. And they have an exercise science program. And so I had started there and I just catapulted through that thing. And the guy who ran it would like took me under his wing because he saw how much I was into it. I volunteered at an adaptive PE program where I was helping people who had had strokes, who were not making any improvement. I got a job part-time as a physical therapy assistant because I thought that was what I wanted to do too. I quickly learned that was not what I wanted to do, but I got good at understanding everything about the body, right? To a large degree. And, you know, physical perspective, understanding physiology and training and mechanics, and I was getting good at it. And I became a no BS guy where people came to me early on because they wanted a badass workout. And so I trained the housewives of Newport Beach and turned them into monsters. And I, within probably, I think my first 3 years, like there was a 2 year period that was pretty rough. But at 3 years, I didn't know what to do with the amount of money I was getting. Mm-hmm. And I was like, what the fuck? Like, and it was all cash, right? And it was like, you know, I was making over $100,000 a year. And I was like, whoa, like I didn't know what to do. And so, you know, I'm working at somebody else's gym. And then the husbands didn't like the fact the wives were kicking their butt. So then the husbands were coming to me. And then the kids were coming to me. And then I had even more money and I was like, well, I'm paying about $1,000 a month out of this gym to rent space. And that gym that I originally got invited to go work out of that had nobody in it all day long space. I wonder if I propositioned this guy, if he'd sublet to me, if I could use it during the day for like $1,500 a month. He let me sublet that, and I had two clients up front pay me for a year. And this was like 2004, 2005. So I had been training people for like 3 years, you know, and all of a sudden I had my own gym. And wow. that was the start of really a laboratory of work that became an epicenter for coaches to come to me in the area who wanted to work and understand what I was doing. Because I was the first guy that had kettlebells in my area,
yeah.
You know, like it was like, what are those? And everybody started coming to me and I was showing trainers how to use them, you know? And it was like, I just wanted to learn as much as I could. And if you're in this niche, in this world, because you want to learn, don't ever let go of that. And just understand whatever you learn, earn shit. Because I have spent a decade with inside human performance. Well, I spent a decade within endurance. I've been 20 years, 30 years at this point inside this world. But I still don't understand. There's still so much I don't understand. And it's just, that's the thing. And now I'm a project at Stanford Medicine now. Like I'm involved with high level PhDs doing really, really cool work. How does a guy like me get to that? And it was just wanted to learn, and I wanted to share that information.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing.
And I think sharing the information is the actual key to it all, because too many of us like when I got involved in the fitness world, everybody was like, I got the super secret program. And as soon as you swipe your credit card, I'll give it to you. And so you'd get this cookie cutter program that they had developed that was no better than the program that you had written yourself. And it's like, what the fuck? Like, what am I doing? And it's like, that was the fitness world. And that's not what it is, man. Just share what you're learning and teach people. And it's like, and all the people are going to want to out and teach at their gym or their place. And, you know, I've traveled the world for the last decade teaching, and awesome. And it's been absolute blast.
All right, Brian, final question. Where did you meet Aaron, and what happened the first time you guys trained together?
Starrett introduced us. Wow. Yeah, he had worked with her after the first Olympics because she'd broken a rib or two at the time. She's broken five ribs. Jesus. And yeah, well, that's rowing, dude. You go through brick walls and your ribs break because you're in a shitty position. You know, you're hunched over and you're pulling. And,
wow.
You know,
yeah.
Yeah. And she was kind of, she was coming down to the Olympic Training Center in San Diego, and I was teaching a seminar down there, but I lived in Orange County, and Kelly had his hands on her for about, I think for about like 8 months or so. And, it was just after the Olympics, and he said, "Hey, can you keep an eye on her for me?" And I was like, absolutely. And I was dating somebody at the time. She was dating somebody at the time. And she came down, I invited her to a seminar I was doing, and we hit it off. And so she worked out, we worked out together. And like at the time I could keep up with her. Hmm. Right now I cannot, but you know, at the time I could keep up with her. That said, and really compatible for CrossFit and what we were doing, she was compatible for rowing. I could not row as fast as she could. That is a fact. Hmm. In fact, I think she has a faster 2K than me. So, but 3-4 years went by, and we just remained friends, and she would bounce stuff off of me from time to time. And then it was New Year's Day, 2012, and she was coming back down through Southern California to go to Chula Vista, the Olympic Training Center, for training camp.
Yeah.
And she's like, "Hey, I'm swinging through town. Gonna stop by and say hi. I know you'd kill me if I didn't, you know." And we went out to dinner, and we never stopped dating since then.
Awesome, wow. Man. Thanks for sharing awesome. That story.
Yeah.
Yep.
All right. Before we let you go, Brian, I want everyone following Brian. He's at www.powerspeedendurance.com. Instagram, great label. I am unscared. Facebook, he's at anaerobic. And for everyone in Australia, just remember, get down to his seminar, Sydney, September the 30th. He'll be in town, so make sure you check it out. Brian, what can I say, man? It's been an absolute pleasure, brother.
Yeah, man. Dude, thanks for sharing the space with us. And one more thing. How many people tell you look like who do people tell you look like? A fighter. Anyone ever say John Wayne Parr?
No.
Oh, maybe it's just the hat. We've had him on the show a couple times. He's an Aussie. About halfway through the interview, I'm just like, I got caught just, you know, a lot of times these things happen. I just got caught listening, and I'm like, oh, shit, I'm in an interview. I better, because you're just dropping bomb after bomb, and I'm like, he looks just like John Wayne Parr, the gunslinger.
That's a compliment.
That's
too.
A compliment.
He's a 10 times world champion.
Yeah, 10-time Muay Thai world champ.
Oh.
Yeah, man. Yo, wow. Thanks for stopping through here, man. This was awesome.
Yeah, you're welcome, guys. Thanks for having me.
Johnny, Brian McKenzie, brother.
Yeah, man. That episode, you and I were both stoked to get him on. Mm. And so many talking points. Like you prefaced before the show started how he's not a cookie cutter individual. That just shows you how diverse and multi-talented he is, man. We could have spoke for hours with this guy.
Absolutely. But you know, I think he's very open to learning. At the same time, he's very open to teaching. So I really like Brian. I love the things that he's doing. And like I spoke about before, like that breathing stuff, like I think it's the most powerful thing actually in the human body.
I know I struggle with it. When he was talking about what happens, like he was breaking down the parasympathetic, the sympathetic nervous system, the fight or flight, I always breathe through my mouth. And I know that that's been one of my, like, what I was always really good at sports, whether it was football, baseball, or basketball, but my downfall was always my conditioning. And I know that I would always panic. Like, I never thought that I would be able to breathe enough through my nose. So I'd always go through the mouth. And then hearing him say what's happening, and then also showing that, like, Brian, telling us stories about his uprise, how where he came from, and then dropping some science. The dude is a lifelong learner. He's in it, isn't he?
Yeah, absolutely. I think even from personal experience, I think we spend too much time sometimes lifting weights, even doing skills, when we can try to perfect something like you just spoke about. Can you imagine how, like, you were a good athlete? Just imagine you could probably have been a great athlete if you knew how to breathe.
I was great at 12. You should say we had a parade and everything. I was a beast. Want a spelling bee out here? No, but you're right, and it's that, like, I'm really fascinated.
You probably didn't reach your potential.
I don't really believe in that word, but I'm fascinated with people who are, because we come, you and I, born in the early 80s, our fathers were like, I mean, these are metaphors here, were like iron workers and coal miners, and that whole generation was really about the action of the sport, whatever sport you're in, so much digging well sort of thing. But now as we're evolving as people and we're getting more educated, we're stripping the action of the sport away and we're putting more focus on what our body is doing during that action and how to prep it. Something as simple as breathing, which you're really into. You've done the seminar with Maxwell. We've interviewed both of these guys now. And how I think sometimes we can overthink things.
Absolutely. But it's just, I think John Jones's ability to breathe and stay calm.
That moment. Do you remember?
What DC did to him in those first two rounds, he would have knocked out any.
I can see it in your eyes. Dude, DC fought the fight of his life, man.
He's the only
man.
Person that he would have knocked out in the whole world, in the history of the world.
Dude, man.
He fought a good fight.
He fought his best fight, man. We watched that fight together, and it hurt me to watch DC lose like that, and then the emotions afterwards. But like I said earlier, before we recorded, a week has passed, and I've been able to sit with it and sit with John in terms of his greatness. And I'm no longer sad for DC. I'm excited for the sport of MMA. I hope John keeps it together. And that moment we referenced with Brian, after the leg head kick landed, the whole world froze. John didn't attack right away. He calculated, recalibrated, and then he pounced. Mm. And it was almost like, what? A breath. And boom.
Yeah. But how much does that come back to him being able to understand his breathing?
That's what I mean. Yeah. And that's what, like, I really didn't get, I'm sure Brian understood that when I asked that question, but that's why I asked that question about that scenario, because so many people either, one, they rush in too quick and then will get caught. If you remember.
But that's what I mean. His ability to breathe gave him the opportunity to think about it.
Yes, man. That's
and in
it.
That microsecond, be able to decide the best plan of attack instead of everyone would have jumped straight in.
And sometimes that doesn't always work. Wonder Boy versus Woodley. The first fight when he got clipped and Woodley attacked straight in and Wonder Boy reversed it. It happens all the time.
I agree.
You know, you could get knocked out that way. Shane Carwin versus Brock. Carwin clipped him. This was years ago, and goes in for the kill, and Brock just, boom, clips him, and then the fight's over. Brendan Schaub happened to him with, but anyway, that breath that we're talking about, that moment of stillness, Eckhart Tolle writes about stillness speaks, being able to strip the chaos away,
yeah,
and just feel yourself in that space. If we could do things to supplement that, like the breathing techniques that Brian talks about, the one that you did, man, why isn't this on the mainstream?
Absolutely. And I think it's opportunity, especially for guys that are, you know, do listen to the show, guys and girls, sorry, listen to the show in Sydney. It's like, well, he's going to be here.
September 30th. I'm definitely going.
Why don't you take the opportunity to learn something that is way off mainstream? It's not a mainstream learn how to deadlift or learn how to squat.
It's learn how to breathe, fool.
Yeah, learn how to breathe and learn how to use your actual body. So yeah. I think it's something that fascinates me. I'm going for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I'll be there. I'm definitely not going to miss this one. And I think also the main important, like, it's so important to continually trust in ourselves, to continually not compare ourselves to what others are doing in our field or others doing in the world. Because if you could just trust in yourself, in your own strengths, in your own career, in what you're doing right now, and continually do that and double down. Look, Brian is proof of that. I think for me, talking to him and interviewing him and listening to him, the biggest thing with Brian McKenzie is that he just got to a point in his life where he trusted in himself and that voice in him to learn and to share. So how often do we not do that?
Yeah, I don't think he gave himself enough credit in terms of the patience game. You know, he was speaking about being a personal trainer in 2003, 2004. He blew up about 3 years ago. So we're literally talking
10 years in the game.
you know, you have to be there for like 10 years. Don't rush it. Do you know what I mean?
And what do they always say? The 10-year, that's usually the window where they say that you can become an expert. The 10,000-hour rule or the 10-year rule.
Yeah.
It doesn't happen overnight.
You can't buy that time.
No.
And it's you just worked on it every single day.
And the advice that we could, I mean, you and I both have colleagues and mutual friends who have been coaches for that long and have yet to take that leap. So it goes back to that Instagram handle, I am unscared, because it's a double-edged sword. You could get to that point, but then what if you get complacent or comfortable, and then you're just so afraid then to take a risk? And that's the dichotomy of life, though, the patience game, and then also, all right, when do I leap? You know, it's just fascinating to me.
Absolutely. There's just opportunities everywhere. But, guys, we really hope that you enjoyed that one. It's one of the favorite ones from myself and Johnny. Next week, we've got Chris Algieri on the show. So
your
we've been
boy.
Talking about this for a couple of weeks.
Yeah, man.
It is scheduled. Unfortunately, the last time it had to get rescheduled, he was doing some charity work. So it is on next Friday. So we can't wait for that one. It'll be a lot
two
of the...
2 Mondays from now, right?
Yeah. So, yeah, that's when it'll be released. Correct, yep. Johnny? And, you know, if you listen to the interview with Jose Antonio, you know, obviously we both have another 50 questions, so that would kind of be a follow-up onto Chris, because Chris and Jose work very closely together within that organization, and you know, they're both so educated, so it's gonna be great to kind of go down that nutritional path again with Chris.
For sure. You know, combat athlete, coach, student, teacher. It's another one of these things, guys, that you could strip away our guests' names, you could strip away what they do. But at the end of the day, the intentions here with what we do and what we're sharing is that there's so many good people out there who want to help people. And Chris is one of these guys that, man, he's in the ring literally, also out of the ring, just helping people, man.
Yeah, absolutely. Tremendous guy. All right, before we wrap up, Johnny, social media.
Johnny Stofko, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube channel, same name, follow me. We're really interactive there. I appreciate you.
Fantastic. And then I'm Tristan Cannell, Tristan Cannell Fitness, across all my social media. So please get in touch. If you want to send us an email, info@thevisionboardpodcast.com. Remember to subscribe via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher. And please share it with your family and friends.
Man, I couldn't say it any better, Tristan Cannell. TK, you be good.
You too, brother.
Yes, sir.
We'll check you next week.
Peace.
Welcome to the Vision Board Podcast, stories of success from around the world.
You guys are scratching an itch, and that's why this podcast has become popular and successful, is because you guys are scratching an itch. You're enjoying it, and you're also benefiting from the knowledge that people are dropping.
I've never met the person in my life, including my parents, that was able to outwill me about me.
Whatever profession you're in, you need to keep working harder. You know, nothing comes easy these days, and you know, you'll get knocked down, but get back up, that counts, so just keep working hard at it.
You know, you guys said you do stuff, you ask things that aren't Googleable. You guys are two for two.
There's never been a time in my life where anybody ever was able to tell me who I was more than I knew who I was.
To join our vision and follow the journey, please subscribe to the Vision Board Podcast via iTunes, SoundCloud, and Stitcher.